Welcome to this special edition of the Theopolis Podcast. I'm here today with Jonathan Sedlak. Jonathan is the author of a recent Theopolis book published by Athanasius Press that will be out very soon, entitled Reading Matthew, Trusting Jesus. It's a study of the Olivet Discourse and of the tradition of interpretation of the Olivet Discourse, and also about the Gospel of Matthew. Jonathan has been around Theopolis from the very beginning. He came to our very first intensive course. He took many intensive courses, enough to fulfill the requirements for a Theopolis certificate, which he did a couple years ago. Part of the Theopolis certificate program is a sort of thesis paper where students do some research. Usually it's a longish term paper. Jonathan produced a book-length study that eventually became this book, Reading Matthew, Trusting Jesus. So this special edition of the Theopolis podcast, we're talking to Jonathan Sedlak. Jonathan, very good to have you here in Birmingham, and great to be talking to you about this book. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on here.
You repeated the subtitle to me just a moment ago, and I didn't try to say that just now, but the subtitle might give a better indication of the specifics of what you're trying to accomplish in the book.
I do consider the subtitle just as important as the main title. So
You're offended that I didn't mention it. Go ahead.
Reading Matthew, Trusting Jesus. That's the big thrust. That's the large emphasis to keep in mind. The subtitle, though, is Christian Tradition and First Century Fulfillment Within Matthew 24 to 25. I could have, thrown out there that Matthew 23 plays a role in this as well. Mm. But everybody broadly knows what I'm talking about when I say Matthew 24 to 25. So That's what we landed on.
Yeah, one of the things that really intrigued me about the book was the very extensive survey of Christian tradition concerning this passage. It's the most extensive survey I've come across in a number of decades of being interested in these kind of eschatological questions. So I think that's an extremely helpful part of the book. What's the main thrust of that research? What are you trying to identify or pinpoint when you're looking at interpretations of the Olivet Discourse?
Oh, yeah. I am very intentionally looking for the way in which influential Christians throughout the last, 1700 years of Christian history have transitioned from clear traditional recognition that some parts are talking about first century fulfillment, like what Jesus is promising is going to happen then to that generation, and where that transitions into the future within the discourse itself. That's what I'm trying to highlight.
Yeah. So did you find any examples early on or in medieval tradition of what we would call kind of consistent preterist interpretations of the Olivet Discourse that would see the whole thing as a fulfilled in the first century?
there are different templates used by early church fathers, that get adopted by different theologians across the board. No, I would say that there are definitely scholars later on who are looking at the past of interpretation, just like I have done an overview. One of the scholars in my book is Bilby Porteous. He's one of the people that tries to persuade his audience in his lectures in London that it would be more consistent to read it as first century fulfillment. There are a few others who did that. I'm trying to think exactly. Oh, like John Wesley is one. Thomas Newton was another influential one. But I'm not trying to persuade people of one of these. I'm not trying to show like a consistent theme. Well, I am trying to show a consistent theme across the board. I'm not trying to claim that they all have the same interpretation. I am trying to highlight, though, that there is a pattern that is being carried from one generation to another generation, particularly in how the church has imagined Jesus responding to the three questions asked of him in Matthew's version. So I'm not dealing with Mark's version of the Olivet Discourse. I'm not dealing with Luke's version of it, which is technically split between two chapters, 17 and 20. Well, a little bit, 17 and 21, a little bit of 20. I'm just dealing with Matthew. And that's primarily because Matthew's version of the Olivet Discourse is the oldest to be utilized across the board by patristics. It's also the only one that has three questions.
Mm. Yeah, I want to come back to that three question thing because that's crucial to how you understand the way that the whole discourse is organized. But one of the things that I thought was really I guess somewhat surprising, but also gratifying, was how constant, as you just mentioned, how constant it is for interpreters through the centuries to recognize that at least part of the Olivet Discourse is about the first century and the fall of Jerusalem. That's not something that comes up in like much later, 20th century preterist interpretation. That's part of the Christian tradition, a major part of the Christian
tradition. It's a major part of the Christian tradition, and that was eye-opening to me years ago, because the development of this research is over many, many years, more than a decade. It was myself trying to process through not only how I understood it, but I was trying to understand why anybody can get my hands on, why they'd interpreted it the way that they had. It isn't until modern scholarship that there's clear and obvious deflection, where there's almost the entirety is punting it into the future. Mm-hmm. And I deal with some footnotes in my book about that quite extensively. And, you know, Bauer, I think, is the one that comes to my mind, where I think I footnote extensively in his Son of God book. Yeah, he does an enormous punt.
Yeah, so everything is future.
Well, no, it's more like a way of describing, for some critical scholars, what they're trying to do is have the audience think more in terms of this was written to us now and for the future beyond us today. And that's kind of how the rhetoric is utilized.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't have possibly been fulfilled in the first century in any sense.
Yeah.
Maybe a verse here, maybe a verse there. And I deal with, by the time I get to one of the last chapters, I'm dealing with critical scholarship all the way from the mid-1800s all the way to 2017.
You mentioned you used the word transition earlier, and you're talking about when you use that term in the context of Olivet Discourse, you're talking about the notion that at a certain point the prophecy moves from Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem within the first century to talking about events that are still future for the interpreters.
It's more pointed than that.
Yeah.
Because what is unique about Matthew's version of the gospel is actually the amount of questions. So like I said, Mark and Luke, I'm not dealing with. I'm dealing with Matthew alone. And Matthew uniquely has three questions. And I do deal with in the book, on many occasions, the arguments for there really only being two questions. And that's subtly used by scholars in particular ways. I'm making a case that there are actually three questions, and I'm defending that, even though the second quote-unquote question has two parts to it. And that becomes very important because the history of the tradition is actually first identifying that there are these questions where there's one and then there's another that has two parts. So there's three questions in succession. And the tradition is Jesus answers the first question first, the second question second, and the third question third. Maybe a little bit of echoes within the discourse, you know, back to the past after Jesus already transitioned into the future, allegedly, to the second question. Mm-hmm. To answer the second question or to the third question, he echoes back to the images of what he described in the first question. But the pattern that I noticed was that church fathers are aware of first century fulfillment, and they're almost unilaterally beginning with the assumption that Jesus answers the first question first, the second question, and the third question third.
These are the disciples' questions to Jesus after he talks about when he says that there'll be not one stone left upon another, and then they ask him a series of questions. Those are the three questions you're talking about.
Precisely, yeah. And the questions in order are, when will these things happen? What will be the sign of your coming, your parousia? And what will be the sign of the end of the age or the conclusion of the age? I insert that parenthetical remark because it's not precisely what the Greek says, but it's implied that it's the third question.
Yeah. And for your interpretation of the passage, explain why it's critical. You understand the Jesus answers in a different way than he's not answering them in the order that they're asked. But why is that the emphasis on the three questions important for the way you're understanding the whole discourse?
I can answer that in a couple ways. One way is because there are a few modern scholars that I interact with, very contemporary scholars that are alive today, who notice the importance of these questions and the order in which they are asked. And they make very strong, weighty, exegetical, hermeneutical arguments. They write theses about them, doctoral dissertations, papers about them, for why Jesus, carrying with tradition, answers the first question first. You know, when will these things happen? And they all agree with the church fathers, with everybody in the past, that Jesus is largely describing first century events happening to that generation. Followed by the second question, which is two parts, you know, ends with a third. That's my argument. Well, a few modern scholars are actually pointing out that order so they can make some syntactical and grammatical arguments for how a transition still takes place somewhere in the middle of it, of chapter 24. And they're not doing anything radical. They are actually carrying on long-standing tradition. That is the tradition of, I would say, broadly across Christianity, is that everyone is assuming that Jesus is answering the first question first, and followed by the second question, followed by the third. So he's beginning essentially with answering, in chapter 24, the question, when will these things happen? And he ends by answering the question, when will be the end of the world or the age? You know, some translations say interpret as world there. And it's important to me because just by a natural reading of it in the Greek, just by the way that we converse, the way that we would have any kind of conversation with anybody, I'm making a case. I'm not the first person to do this. I know that Bilby Porteous is one of the people I document, but who points this out as well, that Jesus doesn't answer the first question first. Jesus answers the last question first and the first question last. And so part of my book in chapter 2 is showing the literary structure. And I deal with textual criticism. I deal with the actual structuring of things, the consensus of structuring things, the lack of consensus in structuring Matthew's gospel, both in whole and in part. I deal with a lot of typological themes. I utilize your thesis, Jesus as Israel, from many years ago as part of that. A lot of interaction. It's probably the most dense part academically. And I'm just trying to make a case that structure, theme, both as a book as a whole, but especially as a discourse, because it's the fifth discourse of the gospel, that it's kind of hard to avoid why, given the structure of everything, why people are still persuaded by mainstream academic arguments that Jesus answers the first question first, you know, and then he answers the questions sequentially. I'm not persuaded by that. And that's a lot of what I'm trying to develop in the book.
So on this understanding of three questions and Jesus answering them in the opposite order, is the implication of that that the Olivet Discourse becomes a seamless response and there is, in fact, no temporal transition in Jesus' prophecy? Is that where you end up?
Yes and no. For structural reasons and just in my own mind, intellectual honesty, I think that there's a way in which the final judgment scene could be perceived and interpreted as outside of time, the end of ends. It could be the beginning of the end. It could be beginning a sequence. It could be lots of things. And I deal with that partially.
The sheep and goats in chapter 25.
And goats. Yeah. So I'm not, Jim Jordan does something similar in his latest book that I didn't, you know, I didn't get to incorporate that into this book. I had submitted my final manuscript before that even became published, but he wrote a really interesting book on Matthew 23 to 25. And even though he reasons differently than I do, but he too can, you know, if I recall correctly, he presents a case for the sheep and the goats thing as being not locked into any particular time.
Where do the church fathers and common tradition, where in the discourse do they find the temporal transition? At what point in the discourse do they think it shifts?
I mean, always by verse 36, but it changes from father to father. So the important thing in my research is to let everybody else do the exegesis for me. I'm actually not trying to tell any of my readers where the transition takes place. I want them to actually, I've given them the exegesis of everyone else.
Right.
I have 16 church fathers, not including footnotes, and their exegesis in one chapter. I have 32, not including people, and their exegesis in chapter 3. I've got 34 in chapter 4. And that, again, it's not including scholars with footnotes. Another one in appendices. So if you add them all together, I mean, including scholars and their opinions, their exegesis and footnotes, I've got well over 100 people. And if you're paying attention, you can actually see that there, that's that the tradition is not a specific single verse. Mm-hmm. That comes much later into modern times where it is verse 36, mm-hmm. verse 35, mm-hmm. verse 34. A lot of the church fathers early on would pivot at a certain point. I mean, the most obvious place in which the church fathers all agree is starting at verse 15, the abomination of desolation is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Which is also, I thought this was very interesting, was all of that language that the church fathers use, once it starts getting to that abomination of desolation part, and they have a variety of opinions, that's where they start showing unanimously they're familiar with Josephus's Jewish Wars. Mm-hmm. And then as time goes on, especially after Thomas Aquinas, they're quoting everyone else before them as foundational people for where they got these references from. They're showing familiarity with earlier patristic literature. Mm-hmm. Josephus is among them, and including the four fathers that I begin chapter one with, which is Hilary of Poitiers, Jerome of Stridon, Chrysostom, and then Pseudo Chrysostom, who's arguably just not the historic John Chrysostom. Mm-hmm. They and many more are cited as centuries go on, and they're really parroting each other, parody previous verses, including the longstanding tradition that there is definitely first century fulfillment in the beginning part, and that is in response to the first question that the disciples asked.
Right. So the first question being, tell us when these things will be. And so in this interpretation, the wars and rumors of wars, all that, that part up until abomination of desolation, for at least some of them, is going to be first century fulfillment. Is that what you're saying?
For some of them, parts of that are first century fulfillment. Okay. Actually, what tends to be is more like what Martin Luther does. It's there's a spiritualization of the church, the early church, mm-hmm. But still in a context of Judea before it goes to Samaria and the other parts of the earth. And it's generally spiritualized there where there's a pattern of persecution and fleeing, but that applies to all Christians. But by the time they get to the abomination of desolation and fleeing, it's all stuff. I mean, almost every church father says this is first century.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
And he's answering. Okay. So sometimes there's a blend, but it is, I mean, I stand by it. It's why I wrote the book. I'm trying to show the whole world that it's a longstanding tradition that first century fulfillment is definitely in the Olivet Discourse. Yeah. It's a phenomenon nowadays, at least in America, to think of it exclusively as in the future.
Right. Right.
That's strange from the perspective of church history.
Right, right.
So no one's ever heard of it. That's a modern phenomenon.
Yeah. This a point that John A.T. Robinson mm-hmm. makes in his Redating the New Testament back from the 70s, I think, where he talks about the patristic use of the fall of Jerusalem as an apologetic point. That, you know, Jesus predicted this and this happened. That's especially over against Jewish interlocutors. That's an argument against the Jews. So yeah, that's the tradition that you're summarizing and engaging. That they recognize that this is a major vindication of Jesus as prophet.
Yes, yeah. And that comes out in chapter 3 of my book the most. So the longest chapter, which deals with the most Christians, influential Christians in history, the largest volume that I'm covering, beginning with Aquinas, they are very clear about that reception, the reception of that view. Yeah. Yeah. And not in any, by the way, I think this is important to say, in modern scholarship, that is interpreted as something that ought to be viewed as a blight upon the church, as though it's somehow not anachronistic, but like anti-Semitic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not what any of them are doing. It's not an ethnic thing like cleansing. It's just they see it as God really vindicating his promise.
Right.
And it's more of an ethical thing for a particular generation than it is a racial thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, just wanted to throw that out there. I think it's important.
Because
it's a lot of history and it might come across a certain way. But it's largely about Jesus being vindicated.
Yeah. What is the – is there a – general consensus or some variety of opinions about verse 34 and the generation, this generation shall not pass until all these things are fulfilled. Is that taken as the generation of Jesus and the disciples? Is it taken as, or do you have the kind of thing you have in modern dispensational where generation gets transferred to race, or the generation in which these things are happening is projected out into the future.
You know, there are so many notes that I did not put into the book. I could legitimately, with notes, write a volume 2 that's the same size of what I have. I did shrink it down considerably, and it's already over 500 pages. So I have to be selective with certain things. I'm not actually repeating the same kind. Like, I'm not giving you, with 100 scholars, 100 interpretations of how this generation is used. Yeah. But I do highlight some really interesting ones. And one of the most interesting ones that I do go extensively with is Martin Luther's, how he plays games with that. Broadly speaking, if I'm going to answer for how I remember most of the people interpreting that I deal with in the book, broadly speaking, most of them are confused by it. Mm-hmm. They see that as an obstacle to their exegesis because it comes after a part where they've already believed Jesus has begun answering the second question. Yeah. So there are some rhetorical, I don't want to be insulting, dances, some rhetorical moves to still consistently stay on the topic that Jesus has moved on to, you know, to the second question, which is about the future. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he still has some kind of idea of the first century in mind. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther is the one who makes a mess out of it. Yeah, with its...
Do tell.
I wish I actually came more prepared that this was a question to be asked. If I recall correctly, Luther, I mean, I kind of lay it on him pretty thick in the book. I just remember thinking, like, how can you have this interpretation? But it largely has to do with it being the Jewish race.
Okay. Yeah.
So
in anticipating what I characterize as the dispensationalist view that this is this race of Jews shall not pass away until all these things are fulfilled.
Correct.
Yeah. So does that mean that when you're talking about the things that they're thinking of as often the distant future, that would include the kind of apocalyptic language of 29 and 30, the sun dark and the moon turned to blood, moon not giving its light, stars falling from heaven? Is that taken as the literal world collapsing kind of? If they're puzzled by verse 34, because it looks like we're back in first century fulfillment, does that mean they've already interpreted 29 and 30 in terms of some kind of literal physical dissolution?
The way that you're even like framing the question, you keep saying they.
Yeah.
But one of the things that my book accomplishes is actually showing how different everyone's systems of thought are, what makes my writing the book and being as detailed as I am in pages and pages of block quotations that are highlighting specific things. Yeah. I could have highlighted a lot more. is that I'm not telling the reader how to do this exegesis. I'm hoping that they're intrigued by it. And just as I was intrigued in learning all these things, but Martin Luther doesn't have the same exegetical twists and turns as John Calvin or Martin Bucer or Heinrich Bullinger. Right. And pass it on. I mean, they're actually very different. And I'm highlighting something that I notice begins around the dawn of the 5th century, and that's a particular methodology that I actually do parse a little bit all the way back to Origen of Alexandria, mostly in footnotes in the introduction, but lengthy ones, that, again, a methodology arises where church fathers end up quoting each other and then using each other's works throughout the centuries. And that methodology is that Jesus is asked three questions in Matthew's version. We all agree when he's asked the question, when will these things happen? Jesus, that's how he begins the discourse, is talking about that. And somewhere in the beginning of it, of the discourse, Jesus answers that one question, that first question, and kind of drops it, and then he moves on to the future. He transitions into the future. And so that's what I'm trying to highlight over many, many, many centuries. Right. Not so much a collective view of anything else, if that makes any sense. Because they all disagree.
Right.
In various ways. You mentioned the apocalyptic language.
Yeah, I'm not going to give up so easily on that question, but go ahead.
But I'm thinking of particularly one of the Catholic scholars that I cite, and I'm drawing a blank right now. I came across a rare translation of his work in English, and I highlight this in the book. He is open right from the beginning. He says, all of this seems to be dealing with Jesus. All three questions even can be dealing with the first century. Mm-hmm. but I can't make sense of like this apocalyptic language that you described. Therefore, it must all be about the future. Mm. But what do we do with Chrysostom? Mm-hmm. What do we do with Jerome, who said this? Yeah. What do we do with Josephus? Like, he's aware of the tradition, but he's saying, I can't reconcile this. And I'm highlighting all those things for the modern reader that they don't have access to these books.
Right. Yeah. So are there writers that you studied and came across that will say, oh, yeah, sun being darkened, moon not giving its light, that's poetic language that's describing the end of some kind of geopolitical order? Is anything like that available earlier? Earlier than N.T. Wright.
The majority of the scholars, beginning with Aquinas and the Reformers, hold that are aware of that. The majority of them. I would say that the ones that go into the most detail are, in my book at least, are Heinrich Bullinger and Martin Bucer. Mm. Extensively. Mm. They are. And they're not just dealing with...
Go Bucer.
Yeah, go Bucer. trying to think about... He wrote De Regno Christi, didn't he?
Yeah.
I remember reading that probably 20 years ago. Great Christian man. I have more respect for him now after studying this commentary. They were brilliant and good men. If I recall correctly, Heinrich Bullinger even says in the beginning of his, just after the three questions are asked, he says something to the effect of, even I don't know how to fully reconcile this. And if somebody has a better explanation than what I'm about to provide, I'm open to changing my mind.
Interesting. Yeah. So the idea that you've got this cumulative tradition that looks like this massive consensus about this method of approaching the passage. But what they're actually doing is there are these patristic writers that have authoritative voices, and everybody just keeps citing the same people. And I think that seems to be, I've seen that in the, I think it's arguably there in the dating of Revelation with the statement of Irenaeus. And, you know, how many witnesses are there actually to Irenaeus' dating? It looks like 10, but it's actually everybody else just citing Irenaeus.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. That's the kind of phenomenon you're describing.
Correct.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would simplify it as they're all citing and referencing the first floor that I begin the book with.
Yeah.
But more importantly, that they are all highly influential. A methodology dawns around that time. I actually think that most of them are getting a lot of foundational things from Origen of Alexandria. It might be a controversial view of mine, but I do have respect for Origen of Alexandria, despite him being certain teachings of him being condemned later on. I think he was a brain. I think he was a brilliant man. Yeah. And what is really happening, and I do trace this if people are reading the footnotes more than the body, how certain people utilize other texts of the past. So like Aquinas in his Catena Aurea is giving a whole bunch of interpretations of canonical history of the church, authoritative voices in his mind of how to interpret Matthew 24 and 25, in which he is citing a scholar named Rabanus. But Rabanus and the Carolingian Empire and the explosion of books and Bibles and education in its own unique way is heavily footnoted in that section. And if people are really paying attention, they can see that Rabanus was one of the most copied commentators of that era in the monastic life, that exploded around the world and was very widespread. So it's not merely the original people that I mentioned that dawned around the 5th century. But it is a long, clear weaving together of thought, which really does amount to people all having the same problem. How do we make sense of this? Because clearly there's first century fulfillment, and clearly Jesus is answering the first question first.
Right.
And that's what my book is addressing. Well, chapter 2 of my book, as well as the third appendix of my book, is... dealing with, more or less head on, why Matthew's version of all the versions, because remember, I'm not dealing with Mark, I'm not dealing with Luke's version, just dealing with Matthew, why Matthew's version is the most unlikely to have that methodology be applied to it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Origen a couple of times. Can you elaborate on Origen's role in this history that you're tracing? What is it? Is he doing something innovative?
I don't know if I'm able to speak on that. We have only have fragments of his writings. Most of what is utilized by Origen is not biblical exegesis. It's just not in the history of the church. Spirituality, in my estimation, is far more utilized. He seems to already be working with the tradition. He does it, reading his commentary on Matthew, which is broken. It's not full. It's not a full commentary, at least what we have preserved in the manuscript. He doesn't come across as trying to invent the historical side of anything. But I point that out in the introduction merely to show that he's the oldest that we have of any commentary of Matthew's gospel, to put the Olivet Discourse at least. And I think he's actually the oldest commentary on Matthew's gospel, period. And he takes for granted the first century fulfillment in many parts of Matthew's gospel, but in the Olivet Discourse, certainly Jesus is dealing with first century fulfillment when he begins this. But then he goes on to, I don't really call it allegory. Sometimes he allegorizes, but sometimes it's just really creative spiritual advice. Mm-hmm. Maybe a mysticizing of the text, mm-hmm. but he's trying to be pastoral. He's not trying to do anything other than be pastoral in his own context. And I'm merely highlighting that what Origen does is, if you're looking for this methodology, if you're just trying to trace it back from the 5th century, I can't trace it further back than Origen. And Origen has a point of transition where he doesn't say it verbatim. Here's the future now. Jesus is talking mm-hmm. about the future. Jesus is answering the second question, the third question. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do that. He just stops talking about the past after verse 36. So. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it just happens organically with the way his commentary works. Yeah. He's presupposing certain things. Yeah. And I'm more or less running with that, you know, in the introduction alone. That's not essential for my book, but I do think that is a good place for other people to do a lot more research.
Yeah. What would be the follow-up research that you would hope to inspire from this book? Do you think there's more work to be done on individual commentators over the centuries? Was there anyone that you came across that you thought, oh, I wish I had 2 years to just work through this guy's stuff?
You're asking a question about historical theology. Historical theology. Out of this book, I would love certain things to be translated into English for the public. Ooh. So, like, for example, for this book, Matthew Colveen was kind enough to work extensively to translate three previously untranslated works. The work, the commentary by Tommaso de Vio, also known as Cardinal Cajetan, mm-hmm. the famous...
it's a commentary?
It is a commentary.
On Matthew.
Of Matthew's gospel. Of the gospels, mm-hmm. broadly. And that one's far more concise. That would be more like a concise commentary when you're looking at it. Even though he says a lot, it's more concise than Bucer and Bullinger. Mm-hmm. Colveen also translated the commentary by Martin Bucer and the commentary by Heinrich Bullinger. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they're only available in ecclesiastical Latin facsimiles. There's no trace of anything that I'm aware of in any English translation mm-hmm. of any kind. So that's unique to the book. I also quote those extensively, not only because of his masterful work, but because those are three masterful theologians in mm-hmm. history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
more work can be done in those fields.
Yeah.
Matthew Colveen could translate the rest of those gospels.
Yeah. Little hint to Matthew if he's listening. Yes. What about your own interests? Do you feel like
I have not stopped.
Done with Matthew.
I'm not finished with Matthew. In my own studies, I have lots of thoughts about Matthew's gospel. I don't know where I might. What can be produced from it particularly, but I have lots of thoughts about the literary structure, macro and micro literary structure, that has not been tapped into, that I already have done a lot of research on across it. That comes across in a few extensive footnotes in the book.
Yeah. Can you give a teaser of what kind of thing you're talking about? What would be, what are some of the ideas you have about the structure, Matthew?
There are overlapping chiastic structures with different themes at the beginning, the middle, and the end, as well as a large general chiastic structure. In order to make some of it work out in my mind, I would have to be somewhat critical of the text. I know that that isn't necessarily a Theopolitan emphasis or a favorable one in the eyes of some people, but there are just some things that could be smoothed out with more critical analysis.
To fit your guy as
No, it's not even that. Like, for example, chapter 13, I don't think is a neat chiasm, and Davies and Allison point that out. But I've seen things you've written on. I've seen the scholar that you've cited. In fact, I have that book. It's notes from somebody else. Mm-hmm. I forget who the scholar was. I can work with critical literature and tweak a few things. In my book, the second appendix of my book is actually more like a Theopolitan quick pastoral, maybe exegesis of chapter 10. Mm-hmm. So out of nowhere, I'm dealing with chapter 10 to just to add support. And I also extend the typological paradigms, adding on to your work. Mm-hmm. And if anybody looks at that chart in the book, all the typological parallels, the many, many, many charts after pages that I tried to do, again, building off of the work you've done, I actually have a lot more of that in my own research. Mm-hmm. But when you do research in anything in deep details, it's hard to convey, it's hard to come up with what will actually persuade an audience. Mm-hmm. I have lots of things that make sense to me, but may not make sense to somebody else.
Right, right.
So I have research projects like that. I have an interest in the Apostolic Fathers and the development of thought related to preterist interpretation.
Interesting.
Particularly in the seven middle recension letters of Ignatius of Antioch and how that might possibly work out. I have an interest in Barnabas, 1 Clement.
Yeah.
Those three in particular are the big ones in my mind that I have a lot of notes on.
Well, Jonathan Sedlak, thank you for joining us on the Theopolis podcast. For those of you listening, I hope you will check out the pre-order page. Currently, the pre-order page on the Athanasius Press website. It will be available very, very soon. I guess some people have already received their copies. And I think it's a masterful work. I think it's a huge contribution to discussions of the Olivet Discourse, which means it's a huge contribution to discussions of New Testament theology. And we're very pleased to have Jonathan publishing it with us at Theopolis Books. So, Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at _Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.